Well, we happen to have our regular wine expert, Tyson Stelzer, on the show today, and I spoke to him about the longer-term implications of this dominance in the retail wine world. Smaller winemakers and the wine drinkers are also affected. This is a bit of a follow-up to our conversation earlier here with Paul Hanratty. So here's Tyson Stelzer.
Well, quite a can of worms we've opened here, haven't we?
Well, yes. my discussion with Paul Hanratty from Delatite, he didn't spark the whole issue for me. I got this email from Naked Wines, who were alerting me to the fact that not everything was terribly transparent, and also that there was a lot of concentration of power in the hands of a couple of organisations, namely Coles and Woolies. And basically, that's something you and I have discussed before, but what did you think about what Paul had to say?
Well, there's a bigger picture at play here, really, isn't there? I guess we have a duopoly very much in Australia when it comes to not only wine, but perhaps from a bigger perspective, groceries, fuel and various other industries that these big players are wading into as well. And it's great to see others like Aldi having a decent go there in the grocery sector and now the wine sector too.
Yeah.
But it raises all kinds of questions from a consumer point of view and even from a market point of view in terms of fairness and competition.
Yeah, I think if it was any other product, it might come under more notice than it is. Maybe they just figure, well, if people want to drink alcohol, they just pay the going rate. But, you know, in the media, for example, such a concentration isn't allowed or hasn't been allowed traditionally. Mm. So I just wonder, I know the two organisations are fairly defensive of their position. They have come out publicly and defended themselves. And I don't think none of us would accuse them of doing anything illegal. But it isn't terribly transparent, is it?
Well, I guess there are a couple of perspectives here. On the one hand, many of my readers live in areas where their only access to purchasing alcohol products in their own town or their own suburb is from a store that comes under the umbrella of Coles or Woolworths. And so they rejoice in the fact that there are more Dan Murphy stores around the country now than ever before, and more first choice and vintage sellers. And that means that they can actually go and buy a reasonable selection and variety of different wines at reasonable prices. And that is something to celebrate, but at the same time, the challenge with that is that the expansion of the footprint of those stores is, of course, pushing some of the great small independent retailers out of business, and it is also, in some cases, limiting the variety of sourcing of the wines because, as Paul's rightly pointed out, there are many products in some of those stores, as diverse as their brands might be, they're actually made by, well, they're effectively home brands. They're always branded or a Coles brand, but not branded as such. And that's all levels of confusion.
Well, we don't know where they actually come from, Tyson. That's the issue. The bottles, and to be honest, I've got a letterbox full of catalogues today as I marched out of home, and I noticed almost every one of them had grog for sale at the supermarkets and various places, BWS. They don't seem on the bottle to actually indicate where the product was made, manufactured. Mm. Isn't there a regulation around other foodstuffs, and I suppose drink, wine is a foodstuff, where they need to know, just if for health reasons they need to trace an issue?
I love the fact that Aldi does print on its back labels, if you read the fine print, whether it's an Aldi product or not. That's not the case for Woolworths and Coles. But the sheer diversity and the number of new labels coming into the market all the time makes it impossible for anyone to keep up. And I couldn't walk into a store and look at a front label and tell you if that was from a new small producer that I'd never heard of, or whether it's made by Coles or Woolworths and actually part of their brand, or even perhaps sometimes whether it's one of the bigger wine brands like Accolade or Treasury. And so how is the poor consumer able to distinguish if they're looking for something that might be from a small family estate compared with a big conglomerate? It's sometimes impossible to know.
I just wonder, Tyson, whether, and I'm using a bad analogy here, but whether the Me Too movement might spread to these two big organisations and whether what they're doing might engender some malcontent in the marketplace, because people like to know the story. They like to have a bit of a backstory about a product. And they like to know that there's a wine maker and a viticulturist and a marketer sitting up in a tin shed in Rutherglen pumping this wine into bottles and curating it for the necessary period and then putting it on the market. They want to go tap the bloke on the shoulder and say, what a great job you did. I really like the wine. Can I have another dozen, please? And I think the risk for these big guys is they just keep churning out phantom labels, which is really what they are. They're not going to have any story to tell. And, you know, you read their own website and they brag about how big they are, 862 stores and so many ALH hotels, which is part of the Woolies branding. So I wonder if it might turn around and stab them in the back.
It's an interesting comment. And I would counter that by being devil's advocate and saying, too, that for some of these brands, it's not always the case, but I've had wines from these companies come up and win major awards in my wine competition, which is, of course, judge the wine, such that no one knows what the wine is until it's unveiled at the end. So there are good wines coming through, and it also introduces the opportunity for affordability because it cuts out the middleman, so they are able to sell these products sometimes at lower prices. So there are some good wines coming through under those brands, just as there are, of course, from the small independent family wineries and middle-sized and large wineries. So my advice to everybody is, let's not be too biased on the basis of whether this wine is made by a big company, and let's not forget that Grange is made by a big company under the Penfolds brand, under Treasury, as well as the fact that there are some great wines made under small family wineries, and even some of those phantom labels are made by good facilities and good regions with reasonable fruit and some great experienced winemakers. And so my advice to consumers is, if this all becomes too confusing and you throw your hands up in the air and say, what am I going to drink tonight? My advice is, go for the brands you know and love, whether it's made by a tiny winemaker in an out-of-the-way area or whether it's made by a big brand. If you love that wine, there's no one to argue with your taste, and if that's the right price for you, then, in a way, the grapes are grown in the same areas on the same vines, made by a different-sized company, yes, but it's possible, as it is in Champagne, for a great wine to be made by Moët, the biggest company in Champagne, or by one of the tiniest growers.
Yeah, and you've pointed out some of those very, very good wines that are available. So I think that's sage advice. I guess my only concern is what happens to the wine grower? Do they just become growers and not wine makers? And I do make that sort of distinction because I think people don't get in to grow. They get in to make. You know, they plant their vines and they wait the 6 or 7 years and they want to make something that they can stick on the shelf and say, that's mine. I fear that these guys are actually going to be, like the small corner milk bar, ultimately put out of business.
Yeah, this is a big question. And for many small growers, the opportunity to sell direct to the consumers through mail order or direct to restaurants is important not only for profile but also higher margins, so they don't have to sell at lower prices as they might through a distributor or through a bigger store. But for many, the opportunity to sell through those big stores is a chance for profile too and a chance for bread and butter. And I could name many tiny winemakers in great regions making very good wines who say, actually, I've got a really good relationship with Coles or Woolworths or one of the other chain stores, and that's really important for my business and allows me to sustain what I'm doing. So for many of those, the relationship can be a good one, but your concern over whether or not these brands are pushing some of these small brands out of the market is also an astute observation and a pertinent concern, because if the world is taken over by wines that are only ever made by the big guys and the little guys don't have a chance to be on those shelves in a fair and equitable way at the right price, then we're losing a great part of the diversity of the great wine world.
Yeah, no, couldn't agree more. Now, let's get on to matters more pleasant. What have you tasted lately that you reckon you could point us towards? And we don't care who it's made by.
Yeah, absolutely, for sure. I've spent some wonderful time in Tasmania over the last week and caught up with the beautiful Pooley family from the Coal River Valley, and they're making some incredible wines from their vineyards down there.
Where
and
is that? Sorry, Tyson, where is the Coal River Valley?
The Coal River Valley is just out of Hobart. So if you're flying in to the airport there at Hobart, you're only a half hour's drive and you're well into the Coal River Valley.
Okay.
And they make the most wonderful sparkling wines, Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, Riesling. And when it comes to the opportunities for small brand success, and we're talking about some of these big brands putting little brands out of business, but quite the opposite is happening in Tasmania, where these beautiful, cool climate vineyards, the Pooley family told me, they are expanding their 12 hectares of plantings, and they're about to plant another 40 hectares to more than quadruple the size of their estate because they can't keep up with demand. They've just released their brand new Chardonnay. It's called Cooinda Vineyard. It's 2017. And the secret is the fruit from that vineyard used to go into Yatana from Penfolds at $130 a bottle. They've just released it as its own single estate wine. It's half the price of Yatana, and I reckon it's just as good.
Wow. Well, that's a bit of a tip. I've bought some of that. Is that what they called the White Grange, the Penfolds
that's
product?
That's right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I have bought some of that, and it was pretty magnificent, but I don't know that I could afford it on a regular basis. So to have something the price, it's
exactly.
Twice as affordable, isn't it?
Mm,
what else have you found out? Now, you did say to me on the last time or the one before that that we chatted that the northeast of Tasmania was producing some of the best sparkling in the southern hemisphere, maybe you said, or the world.
Absolutely.
I don't know.
I certainly did. Piper's River region in particular is a beautiful epicentre for sparkling wines, and the Pinot Noir-based rosés coming out of that area are some of the best outside of Champagne right now.
Right. Okay. Does Tassie do any Prosecco or anything of that, like Italian style or any other style of wine?
Tasmania doesn't in sparkling. Tasmania focuses more around the Champagne style because the climate's cooler.
Cool.
So it's mostly Chardonnay, Pinot Noir as part of the blend and the full Champagne method, traditional production method.
Right. When I was up but speaking with Paul Hanratty, obviously I was in high country and slightly warmer part of the world, and it's not far from the major Prosecco growing area, the King Valley. So I was enjoying that up there, and I just wondered whether that was the only place on earth that that made it, apart from the Italians.
Not the only, but the best outside of Italy.
While we're
talking about wine recommendations, I need to take you very quickly to the other end of the country, to Margaret River, which is one of my other favourite regions right now, and the wines of Vass Felix, made by the beautiful Virginia Wilcox, I've never seen looking finer. And their estate Cabernet that they've recently released, 2015, I reckon is probably the best they've ever made and well worth adding to the cellar. It will age very long indeed.
That's a brand I love and that I would happily drink. So that's great. Well, Tyson, thanks so much. I've enjoyed chatting with you. Your wisdom is always helpful, I find. So all you punters out there buying wine and you don't know where it's come from, relax and drink it, eh?
Thank you, Graham. Great to chat. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
That was Graham Kemlow there speaking with Palate member, wine expert and author Tyson Stelzer.
You're listening to The Travel Writers Show on JAIR 87.8 FM.
And by the way, if you did want to know more information about the issue, you can actually visit the website www.therealreview.com/who-makes-my-wine/. So www.therealreview.com/who-makes-my-wine with all the dashes in between that, /.
Yeah, that's actually a site curated by Hugh and Hook. Hugh and Hook is a name that probably would be known to people who follow wine here in Australia. He didn't produce the original list of the phantom labels, if I can call them that, but he got permission from the original author, who decided not to update it anymore. And if, you know, if Tyson can't walk into a store and tell you what's a real winery and what's a label that's been constructed for corporate purposes, then we're in big trouble. Anyway, that's where it's at.